Hello and welcome. This is Louder Than Words. I'm Jules Prittett. In this episode, we're talking about theatre and drama, how it is, of course, entertainment, and the way to unstick social problems, how it can bring insight, bring people together, and also be a key to unlocking things. It's my great pleasure to welcome two distinguished playwrights, actors and practitioners from the University of Essex's Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies, Liz Cootey and Anna C. Lax. Lovely to see you both. Thanks very much for coming along. So let's start like this. You've both, as it were, trodden the boards. You've written plays. You've directed actors, including people who have never acted. So can theatre and drama improve people's lives? Anna C.
Yes, is the really short answer to that. And I also want to say that I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen in the room. And I think the kind of theatre that I work in, which I suppose is commonly called applied theatre, theatre that tries to do things in the world, but also you might be familiar with it as community theatre, it can have a really transformational effect on people. And sometimes that happens in the short term, and sometimes that happens in the long term. But yeah, I think I've really been in the room when that's happened and been involved in projects where theatre has had a huge benefit on people's lives.
Liz?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about this. And my first impulse was to be a little bit provocative and say, not necessarily. Because I was sort of thinking, you know, it's a bit like saying, does breathing oxygen improve lives? And I think drama and theatre does many things. I think it's necessary to us. I think if you think about your life, I would say most people need a bit of drama every single day of their lives, whether it's tuning into EastEnders or, you know, The Archers or going to the theatre or seeing a movie or whatever it is. I think most people need it. And I also heard someone say that more people go to the theatre than go to football matches, which makes me feel like, yes, we are really, really relevant, you know. So I think it's necessary. I think drama and theatre is a broad church. I think it's not always there to provide a solution for things. I think it's there to be an empathy machine. I think it's there to be something that is as natural to us as breathing and that helps us live our lives and be human beings. I'll leave it there.
So literally then, it's a kind of platform, a stage on which things happen. And they happen to us because we're doing that, as you say, during our kind of each day of our lives. But we also can create the context by which that kind of magic can happen. And perhaps if we were to go back to the fire circle, the place of light and warmth where people sat telling stories to each other, and in the shadows you don't quite know what's happening. But on the stage, literally, it could be in the community stage or the lit stage in the West End. Magic is working, and that's what perhaps you were talking about, Anna C. The potential is there for that.
Yeah, and I would concur with everything that Liz has said, and I think I also would just want to nuance the point of that drama happens to us. I think drama happens with us, and that for me is really key and important. I think even if you are, you know, you're going to watch your fancy show on, you know, at the Olivier, you know, there is still that participatory moment where you're making that contract to enter that fictive space and to be part of that world. And then right to kind of the other end of the spectrum where you're really working very closely with people, some of whom are amateurs, some of whom are drama resistant, but to sort of to use that process of sharing stories, of sharing performance moments, of sharing connection with one another, I think is something that is transformational. And I think, you know, one of my favourite things that somebody's ever said to me about theatre, and it sounds depressing, but it's not, is that theatre is the act of watching somebody in front of you die slowly. And that sounds really depressing, right? But I think that equally, there's something really true and beautiful about that, in the sense of it's a real gift. It's about the sharing of gifts given from one person to another, and that it's that moment of really kind of sharing one's fragility and humanity. And I think, you know, yeah, you know, EastEnders is, you know, teaches us many things, because it teaches us how to survive. It teaches us how to, you know, how to have hope, how to come back with comedy, how to, you know, how to have some good zingy one-liners, you know. And it's that kind of congregation around stories, and not just story in the traditional beginning, middle and end sense, because obviously theatre and drama, like Liz says, it's a huge capacious church, and therefore there are many different forms of that. But I think it teaches us how to die in front of one another better.
And that dying is a kind of transformation, isn't it? Is that what you're saying? Exactly. Is that the in life there are these kind of transformational stages, maybe every day, but the big phases that we go through in life. But also, if we're going out to a show, formal theatre show of an evening, why would we want to do that? Why do people go to the theatre when they could be just sitting at home? Well, it's kind of, what would you say, Liz, to that?
I think we found out in lockdown why people do that. But we also found out in lockdown, you know, our intense need to even just feel that we're together, even to feel that there's a flickering image on a Zoom screen and that we're in a group of, you know, sometimes 20 or 30 people, whether it's a meeting, whether it's someone giving a lecture, whether it's a play being streamed to us. You know, I mean, communion is, you know, that's the thing. It is about communion. It is about the ring around the fire. And we've got these digital ways to sort of reproduce that sense of we're all around the fire, all around the fiery Zoom screen together, you know. But when we're actually in the theatre, it is a whole body experience.
It's completely different, isn't
it? Yeah. That's theatre. And you know, my experience of a play is also about the smell, like the scent of the person next to me. And when someone speaks or cries or make a noise on stage, that is a physical experience. It's happening. That sound is happening in your, well, I'm not a scientist, but, you know, it's happening in your ears, you know, in your canals, whatever they are. And I think what you said is so interesting, Jules, about it's a platform on which things happen. Because, yes, of course, it's sort of, if you looked at it from the outside as a Martian, you would kind of go, yes, it's all happening on that brightly lit stage. But, of course, and Annecy was kind of saying this, really, is that where is the magic happening? The magic is actually happening inside each person. That's theatre happens in the audience. Like, it's the audience, it's the space between the watching and the, and here is my response to it, and here is how I feel differently, and here is how I leave the space a different person. And that's always true. And it's the obvious question to ask, does it improve lives? I was thinking about EastEnders as well. I was thinking about Anna Friel and the first lesbian kiss on EastEnders, because I'm that old. And, you know, that was, oh, goodness me.
It's a significant cultural moment, isn't it?
The furore in the press. And you kind of go, wow, people, you know, but how good was that for us? That was important for us. That was a marker for us. And that happened in drama. And that's what drama can do. Similarly, Grange Hill. I was thinking about Grange Hill. What an important moment Grange Hill was, all the way back. Anyone's as old as me can remember it, in like 1979 or something. And a few kids in my class weren't allowed to watch it because, you know, the shocking thing was that they weren't middle-class children. They were inner-city kids with, you know, saying flippin' eck, you know, which was like, you know, the code for what they were really saying. But, and it shocked people. And there were, you know, articles in the Times about it, you know, but it was such an important programme for those of us who were 10 years old.
So it's not just happening on the stage or the film set or even in the audience. It's happening in a kind of commentary as well, beyond that, in the media. It's happening in all kinds of levels. So these things are not kind of separate small events, are they? So tell me a little bit about, you've both worked on a project called Tales of Spring and Winter, which is about creating space for women as theatre makers and women in war zones. Could you just tell us a bit about, as writers, if we're kind of thinking about, as we just said, about the stage, the platform, the audience, the magic, there's something additional to all of that. When you're writing and thinking about how we should tell our story in this context, where you're trying to disrupt designations, perhaps, in the way that you've just described for EastEnders and Grange Hill, How are you going about doing that? Are you thinking about the audience? Are you thinking about the actors? Are you thinking about how this should look as well? For some, they would need to produce something that sells, that has a kind of financial outcome. And others might say, no, we just need to do the right thing and create the magic and see what happens.
Yes, I think actually that project was hugely about trying to get things to be seen. Because actually, so we invited a group of women theatre makers from various sort of conflict zones around the world, who have a kind of fearless leader, Susanna Trezillian, from the UK. Not a leader because it's very non-hierarchical, but they're sort of a network of women making theatre, often in very, very difficult situations in Palestine, in Serbia, you know, in Rwanda, in really, really difficult places where you might think, okay, drama is kind of a luxury, you know, and it's so not a luxury. It's so essential to people. And what we were trying to do with that project, because we can't solve those problems. Obviously not. That would be crazy to think that we could. But what we can do is we could help that work be seen. And I think that was, I think it's very frustrating because you kind of look back on things and think, God, what can we achieve here? But it was very important to those theatre makers that their work should be recognised, discussed, talked about, put on a platform, that it should travel, that people should see it and know what they're doing. So we did capture their work. We discussed it. We understood it better through a residency here at the university. We had a day at the Mercury Theatre in Colchester, and we made new work, and it, you know, crucially, I think it all got filmed and it all got put on a website, which Annecy was, you know, a fantastic leader in kind of leading on the website. And the website, you know, is there, and the work is there. And I think that's, you know, it's really, you know, if we achieved anything, it's yes, all these things that we're saying about drama is true, but you've got to have the audience to see it for that magic to happen in the audience. So being seen is really important. Mm.
And I think that it was really, I think one of the kind of really fundamental outcomes of that project, that crazy, you know, it was so big, it was so enormous, but so joyous at the same time, was that it was also really critically, as well as sort of these makers being given a platform to, within the UK to promote and talk about their work and to bring leading academics in for the symposium, all of that, all of the stuff that we did in connection to the project. It was also about them having an audience in front of one another, and that as makers and artists that they had a space to collect together and share their practice. You know, there was, in terms of, as you know, as Liz enumerated, the kind of different countries and theatrical cultures that we were working with. You know, the artist Ruwanti Duchikera from Sri Lanka, her methodologies and working practice were entirely different from Iman Awun, who comes from Palestine. And therefore, you know, in the combination of all of those amazing, fearless, incredible women that we were so privileged to work with in that forum, it was also about that exchange of practice and also that exchange of being able to look one another in the eye and go, this is really hard. And I find that my work is, you know, is, you know, well, this theatre company's been going for 25 years now, and sometimes I don't know if we'll ever get, you know, we'll ever kind of, if we'll see the next 5 years, and we've just had to move buildings because our building got shut down because somebody was arrested, and we haven't been able to work because we're under state censorship. And it was just such an important collecting place for artists to recognise and discuss the value of their work in front of each other. And I think one of the most amazing impacts of that work, aside from the kind of the joyous sort of celebration we had at the Mercury Theatre, and they were such great partners, but that was just their kind of, that it gave them, and I don't think this is an overclaim, it gave them the will to carry on. Like something shifted in meeting and bringing everyone together, where they were like, yeah, next 5 years, let's do this. And I think about all of the people they help in the world. And I've been really fortunate that I've been able to sort of travel now to go and see most of them work in country as well, which has just been an amazing privilege. But that, you know, I think that if nothing else, we gave that, you know, that project gave them a bit of, you know, of that hope to carry on. So thank you, AHRC.
Excellent. Good tag. And they've created the magic for people to engage with each other and to feel strong for the future. I mean, you're talking about theatre and drama linking up with people coming from all sorts of different contexts. And yet when we look into schools, we find a kind of instrumentalism about curriculum, forcing out in many places drama because people have got to pass tests to get particular kind of scores, and the framing of education is about cramming with knowledge, so we lose the space for performance and for learning how the world works. So if you're kind of, maybe that means we need more community theatre and we need more of these kinds of projects, or simply more exposure to the practice of drama. But it seems that drama is one of those things that's been lost from school curriculums as well, isn't it? Curricula.
A yes and no, I think, in the sense, like most answers. I think that kind of I would concur that there is a push at the moment to reduce funding and space and time for arts subjects in school. And I think that's pretty indisputable. But I think that what's actually behind that, underneath that, are an enormous number of teachers, individual teachers who work in schools, who are enormously passionate about drama and the potential that drama can bring. Because again, you know, drama often in schools, and again, I've got one. I just went to see one of my PhD students last week at a local school in Suffolk, and she's been doing this really brave and amazing work about sexual consent. And she took her show to go and like play it in front of the kind of the fifth form, sixth form at a school in Suffolk last week. And it was, you know, and there are some jaw-dropping moments in that script. It's quite kind of like, woo, prepare yourself, brace. But yeah. I think that it was just so amazing the way that script engaged those pupils. And it was because the teachers in that school were really invested in storytelling and identification with other characters. And I think this is the thing, it's that sometimes we don't necessarily need to think about it as storylines per se, but sometimes, you know, drama, particularly in schools and community settings, often offers people a really safe way to talk about profound, troubling, disturbing, problematic issues without ever having to go, hi, that's me, I'm the one with the problem. But rather, if I can say, oh my god, that character over there, that happened and that happened and that happened, and I can discuss my life through them, then again, I'm always plotting strategies for that. And one of my heroes, my theatre heroes, of course, all heroes have clay feet, but Augusto Boal, the great sort of Brazilian theatre maker, you know, said that theatre is a rehearsal for revolution. And sometimes that revolution is really small and quiet. It's not necessarily, you know, the Marxist overthrow he was necessarily anticipating at the beginning of his career. But I think that in terms of thinking about drama and education, sometimes it's that small revolution, that rehearsal. It offers us a space to go, what if? What if I was in that situation? And sometimes that's conceptually, we sit in the audience and we think, what if? And sometimes, particularly in drama projects in schools, it's about putting your feet on the ground as well and participating. And I think that, you know, that's why sometimes drama teachers really go out on a limb and campaign to get drama into schools, because they have seen the difference that it can make to a cohort of kids who are really just, you know, changed by the opportunity to speak frankly through the medium of the story, as opposed to reveal their dark secrets in front of, you know, their teachers. So
yeah. Totally concur with Annecy about these amazing drama teachers who kind of under the radar are, you know, really know about education and how to grow a young person to go into the world, and how important drama can be in that process, as we've talked about. I mean, I also feel that's a role for us in universities, because, I mean, just as a little example, I was working at the weekend with someone who gained a PhD with us, Judith Johnson, whose PhD was about the work that she was doing with a community, an inclusive community drama company called Raised Roof, which works with actors both with and without learning disabilities. And they've been working away in Harlow, putting on shows in Harlow Playhouse for, you know, as a community group for years and years and years. And Judith's written for them, and she wrote a play for the National Theatre Connections big shebang. So it goes onto the Olivier stage, and this group got through and performed on the Olivier, you know, having come right from that community position to go as far as the National Theatre. Anyway, I digress somewhat, but one of the things for me that's so privileged about being in a university is that I could work with Judith on a doctoral dissertation, and when she was interviewing members of that group and she was writing a play with them about the history and culture of Down syndrome and also about the new antenatal test, non-invasive test for Down syndrome. So this was really tough stuff that she was working on with her colleagues with Down syndrome. And the fact that she was writing a doctoral dissertation, the fact that she was paying that attention to their work, and that this work, you know, I'm, you know, hoping a book deal is coming soon, Judith, you know, because it so deserves it. And that's something that we can do in universities, that we can pay attention to this work and say, it's really, really important. And people are still impressed when you say it's a PhD or it's published in a book or there's an article or a book about
race
and
its prominence.
Yeah, the work, you know, the amazing work that people are doing, like Ness Brooks. I've just been working with Separate Doors, who also work with playwrights and learning disabled actors and also non-learning disabled actors. And it's, you know, I think that's one way in which, okay, secondary schools, you know, they're in this relationship with government, they're in this relationship with policy. I love saying to people who come to talk about studying drama with us at Essex, to say, there's a pathway forwards. You could do a master's, you could do a doctorate, you could, you know, be an academic. We really, really value, you know, it's really important for society, you know. And the thing about the audience, yes, as these theatre makers need to be seen by an audience, and it also helps if we talk about it and we discuss it and we analyze. We're that critical friend, you know. It's not that we're here to cheerlead and say everything's wonderful and aren't you all fantastic. We do that sometimes, but we're there to engage and to endow it with the significance that we really feel that it does have. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yes. And that thing about audiences, as you were saying earlier, the number of people who go to theatre each year, and this is only one part of what we're talking about here. I think this is sort of commercial theatre. 34 million people a year before COVID. I mean, things have, of course, been disrupted and changed. Nearly £1.5 billion worth of just the ticket income, let alone all the side stuff. I mean, this is a huge sector, and yet when people frame, I mean, you know this, but when people frame the thing called the economy and they frame the thing called economic growth and how that is then played into, well, we'll talk to somebody who runs a business making metal things or making this sort of thing or doing that, that is sort of seen as the economy. And yet the kind of cultural industry sector is huge. It's bigger than many others. And yet the way you've described it also, it's touching people's lives. It's creating capabilities that they can then carry through life as long as they can.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Shakespeare was a businessman and an entrepreneur. I think he was very concerned about, you know, the returns that he was making. Playwrights always are. Yeah. They're always looking at their royalty, you know. You know, we know this, it's very holistic business doing theatre. It's very practical, it's very pragmatic, it's very economic, it's very, very real. It's just really, really real. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of that. I was in Chichester at the weekend and, you know, there's a thing outside saying, look, the cathedral costs £3,000 a day to keep this building going. Please, please spare us, you know, a fiver. And theatre's a bit like that. It's huge, it's expensive. It's, you know, labour intensive, you know, talk about, you know, movies cost an awful lot of money. There's all this money going on. And that's as real and as part of it as anything else. And then there's this other thing which I always think about when I'm talking to people making theatre. I had a very dear friend who died quite a long time ago. But in the sort of, you know, before she took to her bed, and it was literally about 2 days before she died, she put on all her best clothes and all her jewellery and she went to the theatre. And her partner told me about the night that she spent at the theatre. And that was kind of, you know, almost her last act.
That was a performance in itself.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what is so important, because, you know, why does she make that effort to do that thing, to be with people and to watch that performance? And that's what we have to remember, you know, when we're making, when we're writing, when we're acting. There's someone in the audience. There could be that person in the audience. And that's what you're, you know, and that's, do you know what I mean? Mm. I'm not putting the economics to one side. It's all part of it.
Yeah.
But also that is part of it. And the politics is part of it. And then there's the, you know, there's the communion thing, which is why people do that.
And we could potentially fall into a trap, which is kind of raised by the question in a sense, which is to say, well, things are worse now because we're kind of focusing on the economy and, you know, cultural sector is suffering. But actually, that probably was the case since they were putting on plays in ancient Greece, in Neolithic communities, in Pacific Islands, everywhere through human culture. As you were saying earlier, we've come up with ways of creating a thing. An event, a play, an act with real people in it, telling some kind of story of transformation. And at the end of it, we hope it will touch people. I mean, equally, you might go to something and think, actually, that wasn't very good. But that's fine as well, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of, if it doesn't touch you,
probably
then,
mostly, you know. let's be honest, then
that's fine. But so people have got to taking a risk. I'm interested in that kind of space where you're able to take risks to do new things, like bringing the women theatre practitioners from all over the world, but also to create new forms of kind of art and performance. That may not fit and so therefore may not be commercially advantageous straight away, but may change the world in a greater form. I mean, it's never quite so either or orthogonal in that kind of sense. Mm-hmm. But you've got to take a risk to create something new, haven't you?
Yeah, and your reward might come centuries later, you know. Like Congreve, you know, left the theatre because he got terrible reviews. You know, Chekhov didn't always go down that well. You know what I mean? It's, you know, you've got to take the long view. When things fail, which, you know, they often do, you know, you kind of go, oh, it'll be rediscovered.
Well, what about individual actors themselves? I've heard an interview with Michael Caine recently where he was talking about, it's obviously the context of film, that he was now so... disabled, he wasn't able to move around because of a back problem. But that's why he took up writing. So he's writing kind of novels now, and he says he may be able to kind of voice things as somebody in his 80s. But he takes up doing something different and creative. Martha Graham was creating new forms of dance in the US in her mid 90s, wasn't she? She was authoring and creating. So, in a sense, there's no reason why you should have to stop. But individuals are going through life as professionals, as professional actors. I mean, they're going to be touched by each of the things. Has that happened when you've put on plays? I came to see your play, Fishkin Trousers, in the West End. Near enough the West End.
West End.
We'll call it the West Enders. And you've got sort of professional actors there. When they're doing plays, which is a bit different to a kind of training community people who haven't acted before, they're going through a different form of transformation. Do people see it as a job, or are they transformed by the thing that they're doing?
Of course, it's a livelihood, and it's it's almost a livelihood. I mean, I think, you know, for an awful lot of actors, in some ways, it's a part-time job. You don't get to work all the time as an actor, so you often work as other things sometimes. I mean, again, to come back to the religious analogy, you know, being a priest is also a livelihood. You know, you need a house, you get, you know, it works that way. And then you also have the moment when, you know, you consecrate communion or whatever, it, you know, that it's very... holistic that way. I mean, it's a hard life being an actor. I was an actor for a while and kind of jumped ship in my sort of mid-30s, as a lot of people do. I was talking to an actor who's, you know, 32, which now I look at 32 and I think, oh God, you know, so young. And she was saying, but the roles have all dried up, you know. Oh, and it's, I mean, this is a true thing, and particularly for women. It's, you know.
Well, there is a kind of dilemma there, isn't there?
If you're
training more people to be actors, and more people want to do that, that appears to be the case as a kind of opportunity when you're 18, then of course that creates more competition within a fixed sector. But then you'd say, but grow it, you know, grow the opportunities, do new things, and perhaps they're there anyway, and people shouldn't worry about that. You should just kind of get on and do what you want to do in life.
Yeah, and I think that's the really interesting question about drama as a subject area, and in the sense of there are a there are a number of conservatoires that train actors. And obviously, you know, we have actors emerging from sort of drama degrees as well. But actually, in that conservatoire space, in the training that's offered at universities and FE colleges and other kind of training spaces as well, people aren't necessarily going, it's the West End for me, baby. But rather, I think lots of people come into drama and are interested in drama because they have felt, because of their own experiences with it, because they have felt, you know, it touched them, it transformed them themselves personally. And I think your kind of your question about technologies and adopting new technologies is true. You know, theatre is a magpie. You know, we suck in all kind of new media, and, you know, I've seen lots of Zoom theatre and digital theatre and theatre with, you know, my colleague Liam Jarvis works a lot with AR and VR and all this kind of stuff. Because not just because we're greedy, but actually also because it's a critique of those things themselves. We're also trying to help society work out how to work with those things and tell story, you know, telling them, using them as story forms in order so that we understand how these things impact upon our lives in a greater way. But to come back to just that point about kind of making new actors, I think that's a really small part of it. And I guess that was behind your question, but I think that actually, what I see from people who are interested in making performance, who are interested in writing scripts, who are interested in teaching, but who are also interested in doing whatever they do in their lives, it is about the chance to sit with stories, events, moments, histories in a context of other people who all are interested in that moment. And I think we come back to this idea about co-presence and co-presence in the audience, and is it important to be witnessed or not? And I think so much of what drama teaches us is about noticing other people, and noticing other people are there, and noticing how, oh, and Liz used the words empathy machine earlier, and noticing how what I do impacts you and back the other way. It's not always a success, but I think that in terms of the skills that gives us, and in terms of what that allows us to think about and talk about in the world, that's really how theatre enables, you know, when we train young people to notice and to reflect back in all different technological ways or, you know, I mean, writing's a blooming technology. But in terms of when we train those young people to take notice, to reflect that back, that's then them already beginning to make that transformation. That's already beginning, you know, the prospect of theatre changing lives.
And when you're in the audience and you're saying this thing about attentiveness to other people as actors and as playwrights and other kind of, as it were, technicians within kind of drama and theatre and film and other kind of collective events like that. But the audience also, for a period, is cast into a mode of being highly attentive to the thing that's happening, which all those other things in life are disappearing for a little while. Not even, mostly, people are checking their phones, but pretty well everything else is gone. You're not kind of doing a little reading on the side or making a cup of coffee when you're watching it. You're fully attentive on something, which is possibly something that's a little bit rare now in life, because people don't allow themselves just to do the one thing. They might sit on the beach and just watch the waves for a little while and be happy with that. But mostly people have kind of busyness invades all the things that should be happening. You feel as though you should do, but for an hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, you're sitting there in the half dark in that kind of context, or in the light if it's a community theatre, or it's in the street or something. If you're fully drawn into it, my goodness, that's something special, isn't it?
That is something special. I think you've hit the nail on the head, and that is the difference, that, you know, there's not a commercial break, you're not making a cup of tea, you've switched off your phone, you've been told to switch off your phone, you know, and you're in the dark and you're giving that 100% of yourself for 2 hours. You're going to think about Elsinore or whatever it is, hopefully, you know, something else. But, you know, and for me, that's why theatre, when it's good, it's always immersive. It is that immersion, you know, and that focus, which I think is so good for our minds, you know, for that period of time.
And the final thought, you've seen people in those kind of, who've been drawn in, being changed by that. And I see you were talking about that earlier on, where they've felt the transformation in of themselves by doing something different. in this thing called a play or a event or whatever it's called.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just to draw up on Liz's word, immersion, that, you know, sometimes it is about sitting in the dark. And I love what Howard Barker says about, like, it's sitting in the dark is like being attendant, it's complicity, it's being attendant upon an evil act together. But there's this, but this idea that even if you're not sat in the dark watching your 2.5 hours traffic on the stage, that it's about that actually that immersion is within a group context, or even in performances that are that deliberately use phones, you know, or deliberately use modern technologies in order to kind of critique, you know, the kind of attention economy, whatever. But there's still, you're collected in an idea. So even if you're not sat in silence, even if you're not sat in the dark, even if you're not kind of, you know, kind of staring intently upon kind of, you know, the wood coming to Dunsinane, you know, there's still a kind of, but there's still that kind of immersion, that collectivity within an idea. And even Absolutely. If you can all disagree with that idea, at least there's that kind of heightened paying attention to what that moment is. And I guess that's the kind of transformation of the gathering, that it might be painful sometimes and it might be sticky sometimes and there might be kind of fallouts and problems and you know, and lots of the best community in applied work is like that. However, it's about working to arrive together. We don't all have to kind of arrive in the same car. This metaphor is going to break down really quickly, but you know, it's about journeying and trying to arrive together, and that's you know, just recognizing that ultimately, yeah, it's people, and just sort of, you know, really, you know, as we began talking about the heartbeat, the smell, and I was working with this Belgian Iraqi director last year, Mohamed Rasim. And brought him to Essex, and he was saying to sort of everyone, come closer, I want to smell you, I need to smell you. And at the time, and all these kind of students were like, what? Repressed. Who is this dude? Yeah. And then actually, they got it. You know, everybody got it. It was about that kind of co-presence together, that collecting together, and just, yeah, hearing somebody's heartbeat. It's a real, you don't get to do it often, do you?
Well, what strikes me is also on top of this is that if we go back to that kind of earlier framing of some kind of narratives about our lives being kind of economic and that being a kind of primary concern, if you sit and listen to the bird song on a spring morning, you listen to the birds, and at the end of it, you've consumed this bird song and it's still there. You haven't used up the planet. And if you sit and watch the waves on the beach, it's still there afterwards. And when you go and consume, as it were, a play for 2 hours, and you're highly attentive and immersed, at the end of it, it's still there. It'll be on tomorrow night as well. So it's a different form. I mean, being deliberately using a kind of economic framing language here, but it's a different form of consumption. And so much of the rest of our lives, we're encouraged to use up the planet and use up things. And yet you've described a context where we're adding to them. You're bringing people together with the Iraqi director, and people are kind of all being lifted by the same experience. And that's not taking something away from somebody and giving it to someone else. Again, so much of the world is like that. It's actually adding through that attentiveness and immersion, which strikes me as something really quite interesting.
And I think the best drama and performance, you know, they're in you, they're in your memory, they're in your heart, you revisit them, you understand them differently, you ponder over them, even the gaps and the bits you didn't understand or the bits that you struggled with, you're revisiting it, you know, and you take that through life, and that's part of the point as well. And generally, I think I have more of those from live performance, not solely live performance, but I think I have more of those, you know, epiphanies or whatever, or even something mysterious, and I don't know why I remember it, but I remember it because it struck me.
Creeps up on you.
Yeah, and I go back to it, and it means something different as I travel through life.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Liz and Nancy, thank you very much indeed. May your plays be performed in 100, 200, 500 years' time and be highly successful. Because actually you've described exactly what we hope from creating these kind of contexts within which people can co-create things, co-engage with them, enjoy them together, but also perhaps they'll have a long-term impact upon us as well. So thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jules.
That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.